Welcome to another episode of Undisciplined. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African and African American Studies program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
We'll be bringing you some of the best of what's happening in academia, taking it outside of the ivory towers, connecting it to what's buzzing in popular culture, and give you our take.
Taking the undisciplined approach of Africana studies outside of the classroom, into the community, and onto the airwaves, we invite you to share in research, ideas, movements of scholars and students, and members of Africa and the diaspora. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton.
And I'm your co-host, Dr. Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get undisciplined!
Hey, Undisciplined family, it's good to be back for another episode with y'all. Karee, how you doing today?
Trying to be out here with this weather, trying to, was explaining to my students in class, you know, being from the Caribbean, when the rain hits your roof, is a whole different experience than when you're here in the United States.
Tell us, what's the difference?
Well, the kind of roofing that we have in the Caribbean, we call it zinc, but I think you guys call it corrugated. And so when the rain hits, it makes a particular sound that is musical to me that lulls me to sleep.
Is that, I don't know what corrugated roof is. Is that like tin style?
Like a tin style roof, like an aluminum, type,
That does sound musical. That does sound beautiful.
Yeah,
I mean, there's been a lot of change in the weather lately, but I'm more curious about this economic change in the weather, okay?
Because lots of political changes in the weather.
You know, we're just coming off of a contentious election season that was like all about economics and the differences that we think we all have about it. You know, it's tax season. So hopefully you got those W-2s and you don't owe anything.
I pray to God I don't owe anything.
In the name of Jesus.
Just, you know, somebody want to lend me a child.
Look, and a check. Just lend me a check. I'll take a couple. Actually, I'm trying to make some extra money so I can be one of our current president's friends, so I can make enough money to get a tax break this season or next season. Hey, either one is fine. But and we're also moving into Black History Month since, you know, we are in Black History Month now. And, you know, thinking about economic empowerment and economic empowerment for different cultures of people. So I'm really excited for our guest today.
Pray tell.
Yeah. Today we have Dr. Neil Shanks. He is the clinical assistant professor of middle and secondary education at Baylor University, my alma mater. Hey.
Snaps and twists.
His areas of research interests include social studies education, teacher education, and economics education. Specifically, his work focuses on how economics exists as a subdiscipline of social studies, emphasizing aligning critical purposes for teaching economics with critical purposes for teaching social studies, addressing both the traditional and new economic paradigms. He is a 2018 PhD graduate of the University of Texas at Austin, also my alma mater. He received the 2018 Larry Metcalf Dissertation Award from the National Council for Social Studies. That's a big thing, NCSS, shout out. Send us a check. His dissertation addressed the role of economics as a component of pre-service teachers' purpose for teaching. And his work has also explored how race is coded into the Texas Social Studies standards, using hip hop as a tool to understand economics and personal finance and ways to implement pluralist perspectives in economics education. So let's welcome Dr. Neil Shanks.
Oh yeah. Big bang, Shanks.
I like that. That's really good.
That's gotta be a first. Yeah.
That's all I associate with economics. I'm like,
Yeah.
Well, fascinating.
As a former high school teacher, nobody ever confused me with having like big bank or access to that. So definitely first time that's ever been associated. But thanks y'all for having me. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. You should definitely get that put on your door, by the way. But we're excited to have you today because, you know, one, we want to talk about social studies education and understand from your perspective, how is economics been taught in social studies and how are our youth coming to learn about economics and personal finance? But then also, we need you to empower us, even me, us adults, economically a little bit. You know, I think sometimes a lot of us can feel like we're just kind of on this cog of economic of our economic system, and we don't know how to necessarily always acknowledge the ways that we can produce different results for ourselves and our community. So we're excited to talk with you about that today.
Great. Well, I'm excited to be here and talk about this stuff, and especially knowing you, Dr. Connor, going way, way back, both UT Austin and Baylor. It's great to reconnect here.
Yes, yes. So tell us a little bit about your work in economics. What's dear and passionate to your heart about economics?
Well, I think what I'm passionate about is really sort of going back and undoing all the problematic economics that I taught as a high school teacher. You know, when I was teaching, I just sort of got thrown economics because nobody else wanted to teach it. This is pretty common. Teachers get certified to teach social studies, and most of them have history backgrounds or maybe poli-sci, so they want to teach government. And there's just few people who are prepared and have a background in economics or geography to a lesser extent and want to teach it. And so basically it was just, hey, Shanks is new. Maybe he'll teach econ because nobody wanted to. And so all I did was really, I followed the standards as they were given to me by the state and taught kind of a textbook version of economics to start. And then I tried to throughout, I was like, well, you know, some of this doesn't make sense for my students, you know, where we kind of had a high percentage of low SES students. And so some of these sort of simplistic narratives about how the economy works didn't really fit their lives. So I'd bring in some, maybe some alternative stuff, or we try to look at some real life examples of some of the theoretical concepts that were in those standards or were in the textbook or whatever. But really it wasn't until I got to take a step back and in graduate school, you know, kind of affords you the time to think deeply about what you're doing and why. And I felt like I was prepared as a teacher to think critically about history education. But it took till grad school where I could think critically about economics education and to consider how maybe that textbook version or those standards need to, the same kind of pushback that we would say, you know, our history education needs some pushback, and it needs alternative perspectives, and it needs new methods of teaching to really fit not only the needs of our students and to be relevant to their lives, but to also lead to the kind of civic action that we think is a ideal outcome of social studies. So all of that research, all the stuff that I write about economics is really trying to make up for, you know, my failures as a teacher. It's kind of like retroactive therapy. I get to go back and say, oh, what would I have needed to read when I was, you know, 23 trying to make it in a high school social studies class? So, yeah, so my research really does deal with economics education in a lot of different ways. And thinking about, you know, if we do take social studies seriously and take a critical approach to social studies, then we should take a critical approach to economics education. So that looks like not only using typical ways of doing economics to explore critical themes, but also really diving into philosophically what sort of paradigms and all these ologies like that you learn in grad school, epistemology, ontology, axiology, all those things. How are they at work? Even if we don't know what those ologies all mean, they're at work in the way that we think about and teach economics. And so we probably should tease those apart and see if there are other epistemologies, other ontologies, other axiologies that might guide our thinking and lead us to new approaches and new ways of doing econ. So that wasn't very condensed, but it's been, like I said, years and years and years of thinking through this stuff. And so, I'm excited that I get to do that work because it's still an understudied subdiscipline of social studies. There's still more people doing history, doing civics ed. So we need more people talking about economics education.
Sure. And like I have a lot of teachers in the field right now, maybe of the 32 who are in their internship, who there are three or four who are placed in economics classes. And luckily, I've been well educated, I try to think, I think I am though. But that I have given them some foundation, but there's not a lot of time that we get to spend on economics and trying to teach them to think critically about the way that we've been taught economics. But you mentioned that there's like these simplistic narratives or in a traditional narrative in economics, and then there's this critical narrative. Can you think of like one subject matter or idea standard in economics that and give us an example of the traditional narrative versus a more critical narrative?
Yeah, so a very, very simple one of the so the voluntary national content standards in economics are they're put out by the National Council for Economics Education. They're like the 20 things that every student should know at the end of their high school career, at the end of their K-12 experience about economics. And so they're, they've got kind of like a fourth grade, eighth grade, 12th grade. They work their way through the years, and they should know these 20 things. And so one of those 20 standards is income, which makes sense. When we think about economics, we think about money. When we think about money, one of the ways you get it is through income, a job. I exactly. I don't know about y'all. I was not born with a trust fund. And so I do have to exchange labor for money in order to eat. But you ask about like, so how is this taught? Well, it's taught in a way that makes some sense that yes, you work, or most people work, and they receive an income. They receive that income, the money for the job. And the other stuff that they include there are like, well, if you work harder or you're more efficient, then you tend to make more money. Or if you have more education or a greater skills, a skill repertoire, you get more money. And so that's kind of the simple narrative that we have. Like job equals money, better job, harder work, more skills, more education, more money. And there's an element of truth to that. But what we miss, and what the sort of, I mean, maybe a more critical perspective would bring to the table, would be to say, well, is that true for all people? Is it true that more education means more money for all people? And we know, in America, we can take a lot of factors of identity and find that that's not true. We can look at race and see how unemployment rates and income are disparate according to education levels. So, I mean, you might be better off with your income being a white high school graduate than a black person who has a college education from an unemployment and from an income perspective. We can look at gender as a facet of identity and say that there is a earnings gap between men and women, something like 80 cents on the dollar, that can't be explained by education, because again, women are far more likely to go to college and hold college degrees. And we can pull apart productivity as a guarantee of increasing income. And we know that American workers over the last 50 years have gotten more and more productive, and the average wage has stagnated since the 1970s. It hasn't kept up with inflation. It's been fairly flat. It hasn't tracked with productivity. So all of those sort of real life, real world data points, with that one standard would cause us to say, hey, something's going on here that is not accounted for in the standards, and it's not accounted for in the textbooks. Or if it is, it's kind of like written off as like, yeah, maybe on an edge case, there's some discrimination that happens. But if it a phenomenon like racial income or wealth disparity is so widespread, and it is, or gendered inequality in income is so widespread, and it is, or productivity for the last 50 years has not kept up, or wages haven't kept up with productivity. Like these are not just like marginal cases where, like, this is central to the idea of what income is. So income is not a measure of education or productivity or how hard you work. It is a system. And like all systems, there are these embedded biases and systemic privileges and oppressions that we need to root out and address. And so with students of all backgrounds, they're experiencing a labor market where they're going to be expected to exchange their time and their work for money. And so to only talk about income in that really like superficial way that the standards do does them a disservice, because they're just about, you know, we taught economics in 12th grade. They're, most of them were working already, as I said, in a low SES school for sure. But and most of them are either working already or about to hit the job market. And we're not preparing them if we just give them that kind of superficial misunderstanding that's in the standards.
Do it differently. How do you do it differently? How do you make, like, because I think some people would say that is a lot to bite off and to give to 7 through 12, but maybe like 9 through 12 students to chew. How do you even make that age appropriate to even talk about? What does that look like practically in a 7 through 12 or 9 through 12 classroom?
It's a lot to chew on. I'll explain maybe how we do it, which isn't revolutionary. Like, we think of social studies, and good social studies is like asking good questions and then going out and finding the answer to those questions and then taking action on the basis of those answers. And so it's nothing too crazy. It's just to say, and in fact, it might even be, hey, does this standard make sense? Like, is this true for everyone? Is it true that income tracks with education for everyone? That's a simple question. And we would expect, right? We would expect, you know, high school students, middle school students, even if we teach them how to seek out data and primary sources, they should be able to answer that, because the data is out there and it's not terribly complicated to draw those conclusions. The challenging thing is then, okay, we got to take action, because what that looks like is going to be, you know, it's going to be different in different contexts, and that might be harder to set up. But just asking a question like that and applying some data, that's what we do all the time in social studies, or we should do all the time. So, you know, when you say, like, you know, how do you do that? I also think, like, how do you not and expect your students to trust you? Because I also think if we're telling them a story, which is what we're really doing, we're telling stories about economics when we teach them this. That's true in any discipline, I guess. But if you're telling them a story about the economic world that doesn't match what they see, and as I said, most of my students were working already, right? You know, they knew, you know, I'm working hard and I'm still making minimum wage. Or, you know, they've seen in their families, like, you know, they're maybe some of the impacts of racial disparities or gender disparities. And so you lose their trust if you're telling them an economic story that doesn't match their economic lives.
You lose their trust. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, since this is primarily an American system, do you all teach in this political atmosphere, then, in the much the same way where history is under fire, I'm a historian. Are there pressures to teach, say, capitalism as an economic system? You teach students about Marxism, socialism, democratic socialism, you know, African systems? Ubuntu, you know, different kinds of systems of that different people operate under?
Is a great question, Dr. Van. And so I'll give you the response is, yes, we should be doing that. But to illustrate the constraints that some economics teachers are operating under, I will tell you, yeah, I know you're in Arkansas. In Texas, the economics course that 12th graders take as part of their social studies is not actually called economics. It's called economics with an emphasis on the free enterprise system and its benefits. Just benefits, right? Like not costs or maybe downsides, right? And so, yes, by the standards, there's this almost glorification of the capitalist system, and there's really not an any place
There's no
where
critical approach.
exactly, yeah, the
It's
alternative.
reinforced by the curriculum rather than having students question or challenge it or see alternatives to the one that they exist in.
Yes, and come to their own conclusions. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That title I think really says it all, because it is just the benefits of the system that we have, and it's not a deep exploration of other systems. Sometimes you can bring that in, and you should bring it in, and sometimes it you can explore some of that in history classes actually more than economics. But no, there's no space legally speaking in the curriculum for that. But obviously, good teachers don't just teach the standards. And this is where I get back to like what I did wrong as a teacher, where I did align with the standards more than I probably should have. But that's a lot of what I've tried to do is I've tried to write a lot of practitioner pieces that allow teachers to work with what they have or what they're required to do, and bring in these alternative ways of looking at things. So whether it is thinking about more like communitarian approaches to economics, Dr. Connor and I have a piece where we've explored Black social economics. And so, as you mentioned, like bringing some of that notion of communal support, and thinking about whether it's cooperatives or whether it's social organizations or just all the different ways that marginalized communities have resisted systems of capitalism, which are systems of exploitation. I think ambitious teachers bring that stuff in, so that not only, again, their kids trust them to show them a world that's more realistic, but also it fills that need for the civic action component of social studies. Like, what if we see exploitation, or if we see a system that's unjust, we got to do something about it. And so, shouldn't we look to the people who have resisted these systems, or the people that have lived in the face of these injustices?
And that people are still living as a result in an economic system that has evolved from the way in which many different groups of people have been invited to be citizens or, forced to become citizens of this nation. So that origin story of how people have received citizenship impacts our orientation to economics. And so that's what I really loved about the project that we did, because it's really understanding that, because there was this specific story that led to our coming or becoming into the nation, we had a specific way of doing business, a specific way of participation in economics. So in the piece that we did, we worked within a Black school district and taught this economics course to seniors. And we wanted to take these principles of critical economics, ask these questions like, so what ways in which are the community is the community supporting and upholding itself? How is different businesses, philanthropic organizations upholding education? How is it expressing its economic worldview?
Did
And it
you
was
guys get oriented to this as students in the US? As I have a vastly different experience, and maybe this isn't economics, but maybe accounting. I'm not quite sure, but I remember taking money to school to put in my bank. And then it would be put in like a cooperative bank. And we had to like fill out our little bank books. I need to ask my mom, where's my money? But we used to fill out our little bank books, and it was a cooperative bank, so you could tell that we lived in a community that had a lot of farmers, lots of people used the PC bank, the cooperative bank. And so we were learning at a young age how to like use money, what money meant, think cooperatively, how other folks in our community our district was, using money, where did they get their money, things like that. So, did you guys have that growing up?
No, and I know this is an audio medium. My jaw kind of dropped as you
Yeah,
described
it
like material practices of cooperative economics in like grade school. No, absolutely. I did not grow up with any of that. I don't think Karenisi did either. In fact, I think the most common economics lesson that young kids get it in like the elementary grades is they do like a classroom economy, where they will either like have jobs and they'll get some like classroom bucks for it, or they'll create some products and they can buy and sell from one another, which does teach some financial skills. But what you said is it was not that activity, that classroom economy, is an individualist approach to economics, right? Where they're
Yeah.
buying and selling, and it's work, and you're describing a cooperative approach,
Yeah.
which I think it obviously has its roots in a lot of, as we're saying, like resistance to an individualist capitalist system, right? Like Carolyn Hossein writes about the banker ladies of the Caribbean and how like these cooperative economies grow out of communities where they're resisting this oppression. But to see it translated into the school and to see you learning at a young age to do that, that you guys are
Yeah.
pooling your resources. And I think that's amazing.
I grew up in Michael Manley's Jamaica.
Okay.
So Michael Manley was a democratic socialist, or he was pushing that concept. Was, at that time the Caribbean had a lot of left leaning because we're close neighbors to Cuba. So we had a lot of cooperation with Cuba. In Grenada we had a socialist government. In Guyana we had Chetty Jagan. And the United States invited because of course that's during the issues with the USSR destabilized those government. But Michael Manley was a big I think advocate of Julius Nyerere's Ujamaa, which is a vigil villagization system, cooperative economics. And he was very much for that. So it's quite interesting to kind of think about how, me growing up as a young person in the Caribbean, how I was oriented towards economics as opposed to, you guys growing up here in the States.
Yeah. I did not have that same experience at all. Like I don't remember my half semester economics class. I remember sitting in rows, and that's really all I can really remember from it. I don't, and I remember macro and microeconomics and still leaving and not sure what that meant for me. But
Yeah, but I think
my
that shows. Oh, go ahead.
I don't know.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think that shows just how much, I mean, all education is political. And so there's always ideology at play. And so you're swimming in that ideology and you absorb it. And as a teacher, then it's up to you and your sort of personal stance about, whether you're going to kind of go along with the ideological currents of your context, or, are you going to give your students the freedom and flexibility to kind of think a little bit more independently?
I
And I think
imagine
that's why it's so important. Like it's important for students and youth and just everyday citizens to be out and about in their communities and to really give their gifts to the community. Because for me, I didn't realize that there was cultural cooperatives until, about 5 years ago, and I was reflecting on an experience where there was this man named Babatunde who had this store called Under One Roof. And there you could find African shirts, products, t-shirts, books by Black authors. They would have open mic nights. And, my mom even performed there some poetry one day that she had written. And so, like, it was there that I, and then he used to say in the commercial, he would say, "To whom you give your money is to whom you give your power." And I realized that he was telling us, like, and trying to empower us about to consider where we're spending our dollar and to consider what products we are getting and bringing into our lives as a result of how we spend our dollar. And
Absolutely.
so for me, that was my first time realizing that reflecting on that experience later, that I had a cooperative in my community that I was participating in, that was pouring into me and that was pouring into the community. And I was wondering, is that still happening in the communities, in my community today, and then in other students' communities? And how can they explore those communities and those cooperatives so that they know the benefit that they provide to the students, the benefit they provide to the community, so that students would invest in them? They would encourage their families to invest in them.
I'm wondering, Carnesia, because you know that one of the seven principles of Kwanzaa is Ujamaa. This is what I just mentioned, right? So as a African-American holiday, I wonder how much that gets expressed as we're celebrating Kwanzaa, right? But I do wonder for you guys, I do think, you know, especially for us Black people in America, I think we're in a period of time where we're turning towards cooperative economics more and more. I see, you know, Black people buying hundreds of acres of land and building communities together. There was a group who got together in Georgia and bought some acres of land. I see lots of Black people going out to taking up farming, you know, building communities together. Is that just me, or is that as somebody who studied Black utopias, that's a fascinating thing to me. But is that just me, or have you guys noticed that as well?
You know, I think there's been a general understanding, and I can't speak to the Black experience, but I have seen a general understanding of the need to like find ways to navigate the system that we're in. And you mentioned land. Like, I think land is a really key aspect, like the idea of ownership of land. Is another one of sort of those dominant narratives or stories that we tell, that you can do that, or that, you know, private property should exist, right? And it's, again, it's all embedded in economic ideology and sort of this notion of the tragedy of the commons and this history of capitalist enclosure. And so one of the ways that you would push back on that would be to find ways to jointly own land, or seek like indigenous restoration of land, like all of these, like land being such a key facet of the economy, but really being more than that, being like a part of us. So definitely have seen more of that, though it is also like critical to recognize that like those are responses to one of the largest dispossessions of land that's taken place. Like, particularly in the Black community, particularly in the like agrarian Black economy, the land has been taken. You know, we don't have to look back all that far. It's within the last century or so.
Yeah.
You know, so this
there was a lawsuit.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. Huge, hundreds of thousands, millions of acres has been stolen from Black landowners. So these sort of piecemeal efforts to reclaim some of that are great, but they're also indicative of just how much has been lost. And you know, we don't even have to go back to, you know, the Civil War or slavery or reparations. It's like, it's within the 20th century that this dispossession has occurred. And so, you know, all of those kind of ideas are at play as these movements are taking place contemporarily. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, like this land and the ownership of land can seem like a faraway ideal. Like it takes a lot of capital and good credit to be able to possess land, right? You know, and so I think another way of understanding like this cooperative and cultural collective for the community is understanding that entrepreneurship is revolutionary. You know, like your time, your talent, and your gifts, and how you create that as a system of support of your community has economic benefit. For example, like in our study that we did, you know, our students, we brought in several businesses, the J&K Warming and Cooling Shelter, who had in the winter a warming center, and then in the summer, Texas get really hot, you know, a cooling center. Well, this community was very prone to electricity outages. So a lot of people could identify with having to use that product. Then you have like philanthropic organizations like the Booker T. Washington alumni, who would pay for scholarships, caps and gowns for the students at the school. You had the Herman Memorial funeral home, where they would, you know, back in the day when white funeral homes would not allow or bury Black folks with dignity, then they would accept different forms of payment, such as in the bartering system. So, yeah. You know, we see historically that, you know, businesses and entrepreneurship and philanthropy has been ways that the community has resisted some of the economic segregation that has occurred, you know, and some of the economic exclusion that we faced. And so I think, you know, I love family economics and I love communal economics and the idea, but I do believe entrepreneurship and using our gifts and making a system of mutual aid in the community helps us to get there and achieve that.
The whole Marcus Garvey system, as you're talking about resistance, so much of that was built on mutual aid. The Black people owning funeral parlors and all of that, so much was built on those early systems as well. But, you know, that is certainly fascinating.
For sure. And I really loved our students' outcomes from that, you know, discovering like that there was a Black economic lexicon, a way. And so they did oral histories where they learned personal finance lessons from their families. And, you know, finding out that there are common vernacular that is used amongst the Black community to describe things like as in traditional economics, like saving or earning money.
Lift as you climb.
See?
Yeah.
Here you go.
Lift as you climb. That's corporative economics. You know, you have that, you know, as somebody from the Caribbean, you have that obligation. Once you get on, you got to put the family on, you know. Mm-hmm. African-Americans also have that obligation, even though maybe they're maybe a little bit of that erosion of their kind of African communal values, given the kind of hyper-capitalism of the United States. But in the Caribbean, we actually, if microfinance, as it is called now, in Jamaica, my mom paid my school fee by throwing what we call pardna. Haitians call it susu, and lots of other Caribbean places call it susu, but it's basically an African system where everybody give money, like if it's per week or per month and whatnot, and say you're going to start your business in January, you might get the January draw. Say you're going to buy a house in February, another person get the February draw. Say you're going to pay your kid's school fee in March, then that person would get. Lots of Caribbean people who migrate to the U.S., that's how they're able to purchase their houses and to start their businesses, by that kind of cooperative economics.
I wish. It just seems so far-fetched. How do we get there?
Well, that's why we start with education, right? Like, that's where I know it seems far-fetched, but if you're not even considering that, or, you know, again, you only get the free enterprise system and its benefits. If you only get individualism, you only get capitalism, you don't even know there's something else out there. And so I think being able to say, not only are there alternatives, but there are functional alternatives that work in those contexts, that is what gives you the sort of civic action, or at least the ideas for civic action that students can start to take. But yeah, I totally understand. What's the, I think it's Ursula Le Guin who has that line. I'm going to butcher it and paraphrase it, but it's like, capitalism seems inevitable, but so did the divine right of kings, right? Like at some point, you know, we move beyond the monarchy, and at some point we may move beyond capitalism. And so it just, it takes one step at a time.
I mean, like a Facebook group where like parent mothers who are like homeless, they might come on there and say, does anyone have like a mattress or something? There are lots of those groups going around, or people are trying to help each other. And I think we're moving towards people. I feel like people are realizing that it's not the dream, but a nightmare, right? And that they've been sold a bill of goods.
Yeah, those sort of free exchanges, but also, yeah, I think the more like crises that we have back to back to back, the more people realize that we really can't function as individuals, and in the ways that the economy is going to keep throwing us for a loop, whether it's COVID or whether it's the Great Recession or whether it's any number of economic crises. It's like wave after wave, and at some point, you can't be out there swimming alone. You need to get a bunch of people together and pool your money to buy a boat.
So Big Bang Shanks, I know you're in the hippity hop world, and there's a discussion going on in our community about how that kind of a media is having this debate, right, about the kinds of economic ways. I mean, if you even look at the beef between Drake and Kendrick. Right? How that so much of that is about that debate about Black economics. It's like, oh, you're a colonizer, you just take, you don't give back, or what's going on with Jay-Z, where like people are like, okay, he's pursuing a more hyper capitalist pursuit, or that song with Rick Ross, and I think his I don't remember, I think it's I don't remember the other rappers, but Bye Bye the Block or Big Bank Take Little Bank. That's where I got
Big
the Big
Bang, take
Bang
little,
Shanks from. So in the media,
Soundtrack of Black America.
in the media, you're having this kind of a debate, if you will, but a lively discussion about Black economics, or even the critique that Mos Def made about Drake. That his music was compatible with shopping.
Shopping at Target,
What?
I think specifically,
Yes.
right? Yeah.
You need to hear about it, Carnesia? Oh, yeah. He's like, so many SKUs. Yeah. So, since this is your area, what can you tell us about what hip hop is saying about all this?
So I would love to. And so with a co-author of mine, Delandria Hall, who's now at the University of North Texas, we kind of jumped into this a couple years ago. And I think what's important to this discussion, because it is important, is that we bring an intersectional lens as we look at hip hop and economics in the Black community. And so we wrote a chapter a few years ago that looked at female hip hop artists, Black female hip hop artists, and how they conceptualize of economic citizenship in their music. We looked at three artists. We looked at Lauryn Hill, we looked at Rhapsody, and we looked at No Name. To kind of give like these three, I guess what we saw in sort of our analysis, as like components of Black feminist citizenship, drawing from Amanda Vickery's work, that are in the music, that are in that like the hip hop message that they're putting out there, because it does sort of stand in opposition to like Big Bang Take Little Bank and some of the materialism and excesses that we think of in hip hop. Though I think we can critique, or maybe when we talk about hip hop education and diving deep into the lyrics, like just because somebody says something doesn't mean they're glorifying it. It might be a critique, like Martin Scorsese makes The Godfather. He's not like glorifying violence, right? He's critiquing that system, whatever. But what we find is like we look at these Black female hip hop artists, and they're offering something different, right? Like, we use No Name's lyric, "I know the money don't really make me whole," to think about how like it's not money that makes our identity. We think about Rhapsody, who has her whole album, and I'm blanking on the name of the album, but every song title is like this well-known Black woman who has been like materially successful, right? But also sort of talking about how to achieve that success, you need to work outside of the system sometimes, right? Whether it's Cleopatra or Oprah, like you're operating on a different wavelength to achieve your material success. And then of course, Lauryn Hill is talking about kind of how, you know, in Miss Education of Lauryn Hill, in the wake of like her breakup, you know, she's going to be independent and kind of live through her own means. And so we see sort of like these three ways of looking at Black feminist citizenship, of being independent, of drawing on this history of Black women's strength, but also critiquing not only like identity as found in money, but also, you know, we look at No Name not just as a rapper, but someone who's like invested in the community, opening a nonprofit bookstore, sending literature to incarcerated folks, like a virtual book club that goes on to kind of try to, I guess, get folks to think critically about a variety of social issues, economics included. And so that's where I think that hip hop conversation really could stand to listen to women artists who have been, you know, going way back, talking about economics, but talking about it in a way that's beyond just accumulation of wealth, and is a little bit more aligned with some of those critical or cooperative approaches that we've been talking about.
That's so good. I really love that. And when you start speaking about Lauryn Hill, I think about her MTV Unplugged.
You think about me, right? When you think about Lauryn Hill.
Yeah. All you, babe. All you.
Throughout high school, I convinced myself it was Lauryn Hill. Like, people actually called me Lolly, but I couldn't sing. I only rapped. I only did her raps. I couldn't do the singing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Like, I bet you're a lot more punctual than she is, though.
I would never go to one of her concerts. I'm not trying to be there 10 hours.
Right. She's just trying to recoup some of that tax money that's taken out of, you know, 50% of her taxes that are taken. And who was rapping about that? Who was rapping about? I think that was J. Cole, you know, talking about how, like, this is perception of celebrities making so much money, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, even basketball players, but then 50% of their wages go to taxes, you know. Like, and
the glorification of capitalism that, If money is your pursuit, you can never have too much. But you said No Name, and I remember the famous beef between her and J. Cole on Twitter, you know, and how she, you know, her kind of anti-capitalist stance and all of that. I'm not sure. I haven't heard from her in a while, but No Name is one of those kind of staunch anti-capitalists, probably in the vein of Mos Def and others like that. So it's extremely fascinating that you have these two sides of hip hop that's having this discussion and this debate about the pathway to freedom for Black people. And are students, are you using this in the classroom to help students navigate economics?
Yeah, we have. We think that, and on a kind of small scale for me, because I don't get to teach. You know, I'm teaching here at the university, so I'm working with teacher education candidates. So we have not had the opportunity to get it into a K-12 classroom, and I'd love to do that somewhere sometime. But with our teacher ed students, I think they really do appreciate it because it gives them, I think they get to engaging with the lyrics and the ideas via hip hop, just gives them an avenue to think about economics and other social studies related issues that they didn't get to experience. I didn't get to experience, you know? And so anything that you can do to bring the real and significant issues of social studies into a form that's relevant to students in the form of the music that they're listening to, you know, I think we're doing good work there. And then you let the students take it from there, right? Because they know more and they're more plugged into what's going on than, you know, some old guy like me is, for sure.
So what are your candidates saying, though? Like, have you talked to any of them after they've been out in the field and maybe had some practice kind of trying to do this work? What outcomes are we seeing amongst K through 12 youth? I'm wondering, like.
Yeah, I think I don't have a good sense of how it's changing economics instruction. I think in general, we've seen when they've tried out like some of the hip hop pedagogy stuff, they've seen increases in engagement. They've seen students who are like, they sort of like sit up and for, it takes a while. Cause at first they're like, this is weird. This is not what we normally do. Why are you doing this? But then what really gets our teacher candidates excited is when I say the students take it and run with it is when they start suggesting stuff. So if you, and so I don't know if I'm allowed to like tell stories from 10 years ago, Dr. Connor.
Yeah.
Can I do that? Okay. So, so Dr. Banton, I supervised Dr. Connor in her student teaching in the Austin area. And I remember vividly, she had a lesson where students were doing some lyrical analysis of Strange Fruit, right? To talk about racial violence. And so we've had students who, and I always talk about that lesson because it was like kids were into it, right? They were like, I mean, and then they start talking about songs that they know. And I'm thinking of songs that I know, and we're like bouncing ideas. And all of a sudden we're like making a lot of connections from art to social studies, to history, to the present, to like what was done back then in response to social issues, what's being done now in response to social issues. So, you know, I remember that lesson from Dr. Connor's class. And that's kind of what we've seen the most is sort of the energy, like it energizes social studies instruction because, again, it's relevant, but also because it allows students to speak back at the world in the language that they're familiar with, which is the language of the art that they're consuming. And so, you know, we need to be cognizant of that, but we need to give them the freedom and the flexibility to bring that stuff into the classroom.
Mm.
I'll always remember sitting in Reagan High School with that lesson there, Dr. Connor. That was great.
When we talk about economics, I'm wondering, you know, when we talk about social sciences and social studies and all of that, there's never a time that that is needed more than now, where we are seeing the overflow of data, but students don't know necessarily how to contextualize it, how to think critically about it, how to analyze data. And I'm thinking from economics too, they might get a kind of quantitative kind of literacy. I'm asking you a question there. How does that work?
So that's another sort of key piece of a critical approach to economics is that we don't just reduce everything to a number. So often, everything that we value and everything that we measure in economics has tended to be financial because that's what we can quantitatively analyze. A critical approach to economics includes qualitative research. I'm just writing a piece right now about that. And I use, there's this book, oh, it's from like the 1970s. There's oral historian, Studs Terkel, who writes, I think the book is like Working, or it's like Work, What People Do All Day, or something like that. And it's just oral histories, but it's economic data. Like it's people's lives in whatever field of work, you know, and it talks about not just like what they make and how they make it, but really about what their lives are like in pursuit of survival, right? And that's what we're doing when we work. We work to make the money to eat, going back to the beginning. And so that oral history, that qualitative data necessarily becomes more critical because it's a fuller picture of someone's life. And if you get a fuller picture of someone's life, their economic life, you know, you're able to get a fuller picture of our global economic world. And then, as you say, in response to all the changes that are going on in the world right now, we have a lot more that we can do and a lot more avenues through which we can think about changes that we want to make, things that we want to push back against and direct new directions that we want to go.
And that's the power of music. You know, music can, you know, introduce us to many different folks' perspectives and orientations of life and what needs to happen economically and what they believe, you know, should be the plan. And I think it is like in that class, you know, a starting point for the conversation to meet, to develop an agenda, an economic agenda that works for families, communities, and that kind of coalition and deliberation needs to happen. You know, I think it's not to be understated, you know, the fact that, you know, when you were speaking about your candidates' notice of, you know, their students' ears perking up, their, you know, sitting up straighter, their engagement, like that's important. That is where the work begins. It is for them. It may be for them the Babatunde under one roof experience that allows them to then later on, you know, become more engaged, you know. And so I think this idea of critical economics, of asking the questions that are relevant to, you know, our lived experience economically, really helps to empower us and to empower the people and the things in which we're concerned about. So, Dr. Shanks, we thank you, but if you could leave us, it could be a lyric. Maybe if you were to think of money or economics as a color that's not green, what color would it be?
Wait, yeah. That's like three questions in once. What?
Yeah.
You want the lyric or you want the color of money?
You know what? Give me lyrics.
Okay.
I want the color of money. And then a nugget of wisdom this way.
And then what's the last one?
A nugget of wisdom that you're leaving us.
All right. Well, so I'm going to steal from our title and from No Name, where she says, I know the money don't really make me whole. That's something that we're constantly talking about. Your worth as a person, your identity is not tied up in money, in finance, and critical economics is thinking about economics as more than just money. Like it's far more than that. It's your values, it's your background, it's the life that you live. So that's my lyric. As far as a color, golly, I don't, you said it can't be green. It can't be green. I'm going to say gold, not because of like the material of gold, but because I think we've, so gold as a metal is like highly conductive. And if we weren't using it for jewelry, and if we didn't ascribe such value to it, I wonder what we could actually build if instead of, you know, copper, we had gold to do like actual work, if it had value for what it produces as opposed to just what it represents. So maybe there's like a physical component to that instead of this sort of like ideological component. And the last thing, nugget of wisdom. Well, y'all talked about contemporary challenges. And so the only nugget of wisdom I have in the face of contemporary challenges is like, your job is just to make the world a better place, a little bit better today. And so that's what we're trying to do as teachers. We can't solve capitalism, you know, we can't solve racial injustice in one day, but every day we can make the world a little bit better. So I hope we get a chance to do that today. And I feel like my world is a little bit better having gotten to talk with you guys today. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, well, we thank you. We know our world and our undisciplined family is world has all been empowered by your understanding of economics and the work that you're doing. So thank you so much, Dr. Shanks, for joining us today.
And we want to know from our audience if they're involved in any kind of cooperative economic activities and to share that with us so that they can expand the community.
For sure.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Shanks.
Thank you.
Until next time. All right.
Thank you for listening to another riveting episode of Undisciplined. This episode was hosted by Karee Banton and Carnesia Connor. It was produced by Leah Grant. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African American Studies Program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF. It is available every other Wednesday at KUAF, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Follow the African and African American Studies program and the Undisciplined podcast on Instagram at @UARK_AAST or visit KUAF.com to listen to all episodes.
If you like today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate us.